Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sayek. Just a couple of quick notes, things that are in the Bulwark today that I wanted to call your attention to. Mona Charon has an absolutely extraordinary piece about asking the question, is Holocaust denial conservative now? And she's pointing out in this new Trumpian age, this whole no enemies to the right mentality has made it impossible for conservatives to police themselves. And this, again, is one of those many stories that gets lost in the tidal wave of news. The president of the United States actually gave a shout out on Twitter to Michelle Malkin, who describes herself as sort of the mother of the gripers. I'm not going to get too deep into this, but these are out and out white supremacists, Holocaust deniers. Michelle Malkin is so beyond the pale that she was essentially, well, she was fired by Young Americans. The Young American Foundation took her off their speakers list. She has been deplatformed because she's just beyond the pale. But this is one of the striking elements of the Trumpian era, that the president of the United States himself will give oxygen to people like this. And you really have to read Mona's piece. And we're going to get to this in a moment, talking about the inspectors general. But I just wanted to explain. I sat down to write an article about the ongoing retaliatory purges against the inspectors general by the Trump administration, and to talk about the rather amazing flip flop by my own state Senator Ron Johnson, who used to be a big advocate for the independence of the inspector general position, and now is essentially cheerleading what Trump is doing. But as I sat down to write it, I realized I really had to unload some of my own baggage, because Ron Johnson and I really do go back a long way. And if I wrote this without acknowledging this in some detail, of course, progressive Twitter would point it out. And so that's what I've done. I write about Ron Johnson and the strange case of Ron Johnson and the role that I played in putting him where he is right now. And this was somebody I was very close with for a long time and had high expectations for him. And maybe that was because I was naive, or maybe because he was somebody different. But as so many, as with so many political figures these days, you have to ask, what happened to him? How did he make that transformation? How did he go from this sort of crusty, independent SOB to being a guy who is one of the most zealous water carriers for some of Trump's bizarre ideas? So you can read that piece. And of course, Tim Miller looks the latest iteration of Obamagate, this huge non-bombshell email by Susan Rice that was released. But let's just dive into this, because we have one of our favorite guests, Benjamin Wittes, who is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a contributor to The Atlantic magazine. So, Benjamin,
and
welcome
a college
back.
Classmate of Michelle Malkin's.
Really?
Yes. Get
oh,
this.
Oh, man.
Michelle Malkin went to Oberlin College.
Yeah.
I mean, that means that she is a secret lefty.
Oh, you have to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, you get your, you know, you get your secret handshake. You get your, I mean, Oberlin College, you know, that's hardcore. And that is where she went to college.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you and I actually had a really interesting conversation before we started this. And I mean, we should go back to all of this, because I was reading the piece that you wrote with Quinta Jurassic in The Atlantic. The headline is Obamagate is just Trump's latest effort at distraction. And I was confessing to you that I got about two thirds of the way down and came across this line. Obamagate is just the latest effort to divert attention from the original sin of the Trump administration and thus deny its reality. And I'm not proud of this, but I thought, wow, what is that? What is the original sin of the Trump administration? Because there's so many. What are you talking about? And of course, you were referring to Russia and the role of Russia. And so I mentioned that to you, and we started going through all of the things that we have sort of forgotten, that we passed over.
Yeah, so the piece, you know, is an effort to describe what I think of and Quinta thinks of as the sort of endless cycle of distraction, right? That this distracts from this, which distracts from this, which distracts from this. And it all comes back in this giant circle to Russia, which is, of course, what Obamagate is, whatever it means, is supposed to be about, right? Because whatever Obamagate is, it's somehow the scandal of the Russia investigation. And of course, the reason you need a scandal of the Russia investigation is to distract from the scandal of Russia and its role in the 2016 election, and the fact that the Trump campaign was meaningfully, if not colluding with that in any kind of criminal sense, certainly encouraging it, benefiting from it, and very cheerfully engaged with it. And I do think that failure of loyalty and patriotism, the willingness to actively engage with and be a beneficiary of foreign intervention in our presidential elections, that is the original sin of the Trump administration. That is the thing that is so shameful that you have to create giant conspiracy theories and these huge cycles of distraction in order to make sure that people don't focus on, because it is the root sin from which a lot of other things spring.
I don't disagree with that. The reason I didn't immediately jump to mind is because there's so much else that has happened. And as you point out, the one thing about the Trump administration, they have so many scandals. There are so many sins that it's hard to keep track. Like, for example, who even remembers all of the cabinet members that were forced to resign for misconduct? I mean, we're talking about this whole Pompeo thing right now. But, you know, who remembers Scott Pruitt anymore from the EPA?
Yeah, or Ryan Zinke or Tom Price. At Health and Human Services. There was a time when we cared if cabinet members behaved this way. There was a time when, you know, it would have been a very big deal if a cabinet member were buying mattresses from the hotel that
I love that story,
president,
by the way.
Oh, that was one of the best.
I actually wrote a piece. I think it was for the Weekly Standard about that, saying I get all the other grift and the graft. I didn't get the hotel match. Who buys hotel mattresses? I mean, take a black light to it. You know, a hotel mattress would be, really? You want a hotel mattress?
Sold with extra bed bugs. No, I mean, the hardest thing about writing this piece was, you know, that we are in fact so distracted that the strategy of distraction works sufficiently well that you don't remember all the things you're distracted from. And so as you're trying to describe this giant sort of pattern and cycle of distraction, you're actually unaware of all the things you're leaving out because you're sufficiently distracted from it that you actually just don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about Obamagate, whatever Obamagate is. If this was a rational universe, this would be the last time we ever talked about it because there's nothing there, right? I mean, this is what is by the book gate, tell me about what you read in this bombshell email that was unmasked yesterday that Susan Rice wrote herself on the final day of the Obama administration. There's a lot of, you know, people in Trump world were saying, see, this is an example of, you know, showing that Barack Obama himself was at the center of this effort to spy on Mike Flynn. And a lot of us are looking at this and going, what?
Yeah, I mean, whatever it says, it does not say that. Look, I mean, I know Susan Rice a little bit. She used to be a Brookings colleague of mine before she went into the Obama administration. And of course, I know Jim Comey very well. So the people in question are, people I know. It strikes me that the best way to read that memo is more or less at face value. That is, there is this meeting at which the president is apprised by the FBI director of the fact that there is counterintelligence inquiry. the president says, don't tell me about anything law enforcement related. By the way, that is how the president is supposed to react mm-hmm. on law enforcement investigative matters. Says, I don't want to know. I just handle it by the book. And the president does say on the counterintelligence issues, you know, keep me apprised if anything happens. Like if there's anything I need to know, right? And the FBI director says, we're doing everything by the book and we'll keep you apprised, right? That's the substance of the memo, right?
Yeah.
And that is all exactly what it should be. And it seems to me that Susan Rice, and I haven't spoken to her about it, realizing that this was a fateful situation and one that, one that there might need to be a record of, recorded for posterity what happened in that interaction. And so my reaction to that is, first of all, on January 20th, if they were not anxious about Mike Flynn, they wouldn't have been doing their jobs. The president did need to know about this. So he was advised. He did not need to be directing the law enforcement side of it, although there wasn't a substantial law enforcement side at this point, but he did not need to know about individual law enforcement steps. And he reasonably said, I want everything done by the book. And Comey reasonably said, yeah, we're doing everything by the book. And see, so I agree with Tim Miller's wonderful description of it this morning or yesterday on the Bulwark, that this is a nothing burger of such magnitude that it is the nothing burger continent on which all other nothing burgers are erected.
And yet that may not matter to Trump world, which is continuing to push this out. Of course, you have the usual suspects flogging this, and then you have Ted Cruz who is tweeting about it, and it just sort of takes on a life of its own. But let's go back to your main thesis, though, and I don't want to fall into the trap of being distracted. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
One thing before we get undistracted by this.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a pattern. Not merely of distraction, but on the Flynn stuff, of taking perfectly anodyne, normal behaviors by the FBI or by the administration and making them into something they're not. So this whole scandal, so to speak, about unmasking, this list that your friend Ron Johnson procured of people who had unmasked Flynn, that is a list that does not apparently include the Sergei Kislyak Flynn calls at all, because those calls, those unmaskings, almost all of them take place a month before the Flynn, 2 weeks right. before the Flynn Kislyak calls. And by the way, those unmaskings were for an NSA product, not the FBI's product, and the Flynn Kislyak intercept was intercepted by the FBI. So while everyone's running around with tearing their hair out about these scandalous unmaskings, it's all quite a non sequitur if the issue is Flynn's relationship with Sergei Kislyak.
But as you lay it out, it's very clear that, as you point out, these are just routine. There's nothing scandalous about this whatsoever. But I guess the point maybe is not the actual facts, the actual reality. It's just enough smoke, enough dust that you can throw to be able to throw something else out into the universe for people who love conspiracies, who have been primed to believe that the deep state is out to get Donald Trump. And again, it is the ultimate distraction. And
I'm going to start Sykes-gate.
I would like to have a Sykes-gate. There's got to be a Sykes-gate.
It sounds better than Obamagate. Like, I mean, there's, it's Sykes-gate, and it's got a whole, you know what the crime is, Charlie.
The original sin?
Yeah, you know. You don't need to ask me that. You know what the crime is, and so does everyone else.
But I was hoping they wouldn't find out, and now I'm busted.
Yeah,
and that's going to be a problem.
Now you've clearly distracted me. If we say it enough, a certain group of people who are predisposed to want to believe that you're a bad guy and want to believe, you know, they'll believe it. Because there's
plenty of evidence for that. We don't need anything more. Absolutely. But let's go back to your original point. And we've spent this time talking about Obamagate, which does not really exist, but that it is this latest effort at distraction. And your piece in The Atlantic, I thought, did a masterful job of laying out, you know, that the specifics of Obamagate are less important than what it is not about, which is, and then you list, you know, all of these things, you know, the pandemic, which has killed more than 90,000 Americans, partly as a consequence of Trump's own catastrophic and ongoing failures of government. It gives, you know, fans something to seize on rather than thinking about the ineptitude of Jared Kushner's pandemic task force, or the consistent lack of personal protective equipment at the hospitals, or the government's failure to establish the alleged drive-through testing centers that Trump promised in mid-March. And you go on and on and on, all the things that we're being distracted from, including this ongoing dismantling of the oversight function performed by the inspectors general. And I kind of started with this, saying that my Ron Johnson apologia, confession about Ron Johnson, really began because I wanted to talk about the inspectors general and what's happening to them. So give me your take on all of this. And, you know, I think there's so many different aspects, including the fact that the president appears to be, at least, and I'm not a lawyer, but ignoring the actual requirements of the law. Republicans in the Senate, some of them have sort of mildly sort of waved, oh, no, don't do that. But of course, they're not going to do anything about it. So what are the consequences of this rolling purge of these watchdogs?
Well, so there's a bunch of questions wrapped up in there, and let me disaggregate them a little bit. First of all, the president is within his legal rights to fire IGs. Mm-hmm. He may not be within his legal rights to do in the specific way that he's doing these replacements, where you give notice, the required 30 days notice of a removal, then immediately put someone on leave and then create an acting in that position while the person is on leave. But the underlying firings are lawful. And that said, they are completely unprecedented. It is a genuine war on the idea of internal executive branch oversight, which was something that had a lot of bipartisan and nonpartisan agreement until, you know, very recently. There is no good government argument for this. The reasons that the president has stated for the removal of some of these people is, you know, in the formal sense that he's just lost confidence in them. But when you get him on his, in a moment of candor, like if you ask him, and it's not a letter from the White House counsel, right, but it's Donald Trump talking, he makes very clear that he removed Atkinson from the Inspector General of the intelligence community because he forwarded the whistleblower report to Congress. He makes very clear that he doesn't like Glenn Fine, doesn't want Glenn Fine poking around on the money that the trillions of dollars that the Congress has appropriated for in connection with the coronavirus relief. He makes clear that he has removed, the woman who wrote a report he did not like at HHS, and he has been very open that he removed the the latest one, the State Department IG, because Mike Pompeo asked him to. And this guy appears to have been investigating Pompeo's use of political appointees to, you know, do personal services for himself and his wife, as well as
walk his dog,
walk his dog, that sort of thing, as make dinner reservations, as well as investigating Saudi arms sales. And so, you know, they haven't really made a secret of the fact that the goal is to attack the architecture of internal executive branch oversight. And, you know, you don't have to believe me about that. Just listen to what they're saying about it. And, you know, and so I think the best way to understand it is of a piece with the removal of Jim Comey at the very beginning of the administration, the subsequent removal of Jeff Sessions as Attorney General when Sessions refused to insisted on recusing himself and, you know, did not use the Justice Department to go after Hillary Clinton and protect the president. It's part of the same pattern where anybody in within the administration who's subject to presidential firing, who is capable of conducting an investigation that actually threatens the president or his friends like Pompeo, who is subject to presidential removal and lifts a finger to do that sort of work, gets fired. And I just don't know how to see it in a more charitable light.
You know, take as I'm listening to you, you know, pull the lens back a little bit, or you know, take a 30,000 foot view of what Trump is doing and has done, that he set out to discredit or remove almost every independent check on his behavior and his power. You know, whether you're talking about the media discrediting them, any critic, anyone who is a watchdog to either discredit or fire them, and, you know, rather systematically, now, whether it will work or not, the Congress, of course, you know, continues to be able to scrutinize him, but he's stonewalled them. And clearly you have Republicans in the Senate who have unilaterally surrendered completely. They have no intention whatsoever of trying to rein in the president. But there is an obsession on the president's part, isn't there, to make sure that anyone who, you know, would be able to expose some either the incompetence or the corruption of his administration is either discredited or removed from a position where they can do anything about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and by the way, you say either discredited or removed. He often does both.
Right, right.
And so, you know, the removal is followed by or sometimes preceded by or coincides with a campaign of defamation. You know, the way he has talked about some of the former FBI officials, not just Jim Comey, but also, you know, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, you know, at rally after rally after rally, the way he talks about Michael Atkinson, the Inspector General of the intelligence community. It is not simply that he's removing these people. It is that he is ginning up an enemy of the people kind of public attitude toward them. And that is designed to create an environment in which the things they say are not heard.
Sure. Right? It immunizes him against that. It immunizes him against the whistleblowers. It immunizes him against these kind of investigations. And so he does have, 40% of the country where, quite frankly, anything that comes out about him, they're going to be able, they'll easily have a one-sentence way of dismissing that person.
But, right.
And again, go ahead.
And the part, of course, that he has failed utterly to neuter, although he has inoculated himself against, is the press. Because While he can label people enemy of the people and create an environment in which large numbers of people, you know, do not care that the New York Times did a 30,000 word, I've just made that number up, but a gigantic, you know, story about his history of tax fraud. And, you know, no, people don't even notice that they did those years of work. That is, he can't prevent them from doing it. And similarly, he can neuter the Senate by means of, and even weaponize the Senate by means of the partisan polarization and Republican control, so that the Senate, instead of doing oversight of the administration, harasses his critics. But he cannot neuter the House, which is in Democratic control and has been an instrument of genuine oversight on a pretty consistent basis for the last year and a half.
You know, I know it seems like an old point to keep coming back to is, why are Republicans in the Senate so unwilling to effectively do their job or to stand by their own prerogatives? But it is remarkable. And of course, we get that story now that the president goes and has lunch with them. And even the senators from in really vulnerable seats have decided that, hey, we're all in this together. So we're going to go along with President Trump no matter what he wants, because we're either going to rise or fall together. So they are all in. But I am reminded of the fact that there was once a time when you could be a watchdog and it would actually enhance your career. And I think a perfect example is Harry Truman. You know, Harry Truman, as a United States senator, headed up a commission during World War II, looking at waste in the military, in the armed forces. And he was very, very aggressive as a watchdog. And you think about, you know, how risky and touchy that must have been to be, be a watchdog, you know, during a world war, a genuine national emergency. He was a Democrat and he was going after things that were being done by the Democratic administration, the very popular FDR. And in fact, not only did that not destroy his career, FDR picked him to be vice president of the United States.
Yeah.
So look this up. Look up the Truman Commission.
Look, it is a relatively recent thing that partisanship has always been in tension with institutional prerogatives. But it is a relatively recent thing that it has completely defeated institutional prerogative, and that you can assume that the Senate will, in Republican hands, facing a Republican president, not assert its institutional prerogatives at all. That may be a very good argument for divided government, in the sense that at least Congress can sort of act like Congress and can act like a check. Right now, I think the bigger exigency is the utter defeat of Republicans in the Senate. And I, as much as I want to see a revitalization of the congressional prerogatives and the assertion of those, In an immediate sense, I think it is really important that the people who are responsible for this utter failure of oversight over the last three and a half years in the Senate lose. And the ironic result of that may well be a Democratic Senate that is unwilling to engage in oversight against a Democratic president. And, you know, that would be an unfortunate collateral consequence of something that I think is very important that it happened.
Well, and you can see that as well. Just on this issue of the Senate, I don't want to be distracted too much for this. In my newsletter, I quoted something about some of the things that the Lincoln Project is doing. Of course, that's George Conway's organization, and they've run some ads that got in under Donald Trump's skin. But it's interesting that, I think in part because Trump lashed out at them for their Morning in America ad, they raised their profile, they've raised money, and they're becoming a thing. They're actually running ads in some of these Senate seats, and they are powerful. And the one that's really worth watching is they have a really brutal ad about Martha McSally going full Trump, and why she is, you know, not standing up for Arizona as opposed to being a shill for the Trump administration. And the Lincoln Project ran that in Arizona. And you just watch her numbers begin to sink. I mean, she is in deep trouble. She is way behind in that race, likely to be defeated for reelection. And so it is one of those interesting moments where the Lincoln Project is part of the completely irrelevant, completely dead as a doornail, never Trump movement. And yet suddenly, and yet amazingly, they are having a moment where they might affect some of these races, because who knew? You know, if you have, 9% of Republicans decide that they are going to bail on their party, believe it or not, Ben, that can change an election. That can flip an election.
Yeah, and Trump's numbers have been relatively resilient in the face of catastrophic failure. But when your baseline approval rating is in the 42% to 44% range, relatively marginal changes in that take you from the land of possible to be reelected to impossible to be reelected, and catastrophic loss, a la Jimmy Carter. And so you don't have to imagine, and I think you're seeing that in some of the swing states that you in the Senate races, that when Trump is really holding his own, Martha McSally is competitive. But she drops off sharply before he does. And he's lost a little bit of ground in Arizona to Biden, and she's lost a lot of ground to Kelly. Right. And so I think those top line approval numbers and their relative stability can be a little bit deceptive about how the degree to which his position is eroding.
So today, this is a good segue to the president's obsession of the day in the midst of this pandemic and the economic meltdown. President is lashing out at Michigan. You saw this about 3 hours ago. The president tweeted, breaking: Michigan sends absentee ballots, not true, just applications, to 7.7 million people ahead of the primaries and general election. This was done illegally. No. And without authorization by a rogue Secretary of State, completely untrue. I will ask to hold up funding to Michigan if they want to go down this voter fraud path. And then he followed this up by lashing out at Nevada as well. The Secretary of State in Michigan then answered him, saying, hey, I also have a name. It's Jocelyn Benson. And we sent applications, not ballots, just like my Republican colleagues in Iowa, Georgia, Nebraska, and West Virginia. So we're going to have a massive fight over mail-in ballots, over the way that people elect. And clearly, Donald Trump is going to play the voter fraud card one way or another, including, obviously, most dramatically if he loses. But as we know, he'll play it even if he wins.
Yeah, so I think that's right. I do think on the Michigan thing, there's an additional factor, which is that in central Michigan right now, there have been two major dam breaks, and there is a giant flood happening that is displacing 10,000 people from their homes and is likely to destroy a lot of people's residences as these floodwaters that the dams were holding back rise. And so the president is, taking time during a very significant natural disaster in Michigan to falsely complain about voter fraud that doesn't exist in connection with the state Secretary of State sending ballots that are not being sent to voters. It's a remarkable, talk about distraction. This is not what the president should be talking about that's going on in Michigan right now. On the voter point, you're absolutely right. It is going to be a very ugly thing at a time when we should be coming together and saying, in the midst of a pandemic crisis, how are we going to ensure that we can do an election in a safe and orderly fashion where people actually have the ability to exercise the franchise. Instead, we're the president is quite openly, again, I mean, he's basically said if we send people ballots, they'll never vote for Republicans. I mean, he hasn't been subtle about what he's trying to do here. And it is, I mean, it is awful. The one piece of good news here, and you alluded to it, is that actually a lot of Republican secretaries of state are doing the right thing here in a quiet sort of way. Trump isn't drawing attention to that. He's complaining only when Democratic secretaries of state do it. But the, you know, a bunch of states are quietly trying to do the right thing here, and not all of them are Democratic led. And so that I do think is an encouraging sign. And with any luck, what we'll have is a lot of movement in the right direction by state governments and county officials, and the president being the sort of kibitzer and whiner in chief about it from his Twitter feed. Is not an optimal arrangement, but I think that's the best we can hope for here.
Well, and as you point out, one of the dirty secrets is that Republicans have very aggressively used mail-in ballots and absentee voting. Obviously, any political party, you know, worth its salt is going to be doing that sort of thing. So the mail-in ballots and sending out applications is really central to any get out the vote effort by either political party. And that's just the reality. And I think that this is also one of those common sense things where people, I think, like the convenience of doing this. They understand why you would do this at this particular time. But a couple of things about this. Number one, that was the point that you made about the fact that there is a natural disaster occurring in Michigan right now, and he's threatening to withhold money from them. He is threatening to punish the entire state of Michigan. And it's not clear what funds he would withhold, whether he could withhold them, but to punish the state of Michigan, a swing state, because of the issue of because they're making it easier for people to vote. This strikes me as not one of those moments of great 12-dimensional chess. It strikes me as another moment of the petulant id of the president lashing out. So you have that lack of empathy there. Number two, I guess this mentality that we want to make it hard for people to vote. Coming from where I come from, I understand why people are concerned about voter integrity, ballot integrity, and voter fraud. But as you point out, there seems to be just this, like, let's just say it, that we don't want more people to vote because if everybody voted, they wouldn't vote for us, which is a terrible position to have. So,
and
not
by the
only
way,
do you
for
have,
which there is no empirical evidence.
There is none. No, there is none. But I think the president is also setting up a predicate where we go through what I think is going to be a tremendously divisive and horrible campaign. And at the end of which he and his folks will challenge the legitimacy of the election itself and the results. They are setting us up to challenge that. And in terms of worst case scenarios, I'm sorry, I like the fact that you grabbed for the optimism, but I look at that with dread, that not only do we not lance the boil or, you know, break the fever in November, we just move into a new phase where you have a large portion of Americans that no longer believe that our democracy works at the most fundamental level.
So I agree with you that is a nightmare scenario. I will say that we already have that situation, right? So a lot of Democrats have believed that since Bush v. Gore, or at least have stored that in the back of their mind since then. And I think even more of them came to believe it after the 2016 election. You know, it is a fact that many Democrats are ambiently aware of, that a Republican president has not been elected with a majority of the vote, other than George W. Bush's re-election, but elected as an original matter with a majority of the vote since George H.W. Bush, which is, you know, before the lifetimes of a substantial number of new voters. And so I do think there is a substantial, and I don't say this with any glee, I say it with a lot of anxiety. There are a lot of people who already believe that. They tend to be on the left, and it is a creature that has been exacerbated by the efforts at voter ID laws and other tactics that they describe or think of as voter suppression efforts, with some justice. And so I think the risk that you're describing is a risk of a whole lot of people on the right coming, stoked by Trump, coming to share the suspicions
yes.
that people on the left have had for a long time, and that kind of hollowing out of basic confidence in democratic elections and support for them and their integrity is, I agree, a very dangerous thing. I just do think we've already gone down a fair distance along that road.
Yeah, but it's like Bush v. Gore times what? Times 100? Times a good billion?
You know, if the point is the president is unlikely to handle the matter with the grace that Al Gore showed in 2000, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And Gore, if you think about how angry Democrats were and what Gore did, which was to, when the Supreme Court ruled, back out gracefully and never question the legitimacy of Bush's election. There is no chance that Trump will do that.
Zero.
And he will not do that. And by the way, that was the hard case where the election was genuinely in contest. You know, nobody to this day, nobody knows who won that election. And Trump will do that, will behave with a total lack of grace, even if it is unambiguously clear that he lost.
No, there's no question about that. And you mentioned Gore, and one of the great ironies of history, there was also the decision by Richard Nixon back in 1960 not to contest the results of that election, which were incredibly close. And then people thought that perhaps he should have. And again, who knows? But, you know, so there was once a time where someone would make the calculation, I could make an issue of this. It would be in my personal interest, but it would hurt the country. And the damage it would do to the country outweighs any advantage of my contesting this election. And yeah, we cannot count on that happening.
But one other thing on that, I don't think the issue is limited to the immediate aftermath of the election. Imagine that Trump loses. And, you know, yeah, there's an ugly 3 months in which he doesn't accept it. And then the mechanistic qualities of the system resolve it and Joe Biden becomes president. Donald Trump is not going to disappear into the woodwork the way traditional former presidents have.
Well, this is my concern.
He's going to be tweeting every day. He's going to be stoking a new a kind of revisionism, and which will be very conspiracy driven. And, you know, he is, we don't like to acknowledge his talents and virtues, but he is an extremely good showman, and he will remain omnipresent in people's consciousnesses, because that is his superpower, that as well as shamelessness, as you always point out. Omnipresence, and he will, unlike Barack Obama or George W. Bush, he will be eligible to run again if he is defeated. And I think that campaign will start almost immediately upon his leaving office.
I want people to know that I agree with this absolutely completely, and I don't think people have gotten their heads around this, that this goes on. In fact, this may go on for decades in terms of the legend that the corrupt bargain, that's an historic reference, that put Joe Biden into office, or the stab in the back.
The stab in the back.
You know where I'm going with that.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that is a you know, something that had zero factual basis and became an extremely powerful motivating mythology for large numbers of ordinary Germans over the course of the 1920s. And it had grave, grave historical consequences. Yeah. And it's exactly the kind of... So it was the belief that Germany had not been defeated on the battlefield in World War I, but had been stabbed in the back and and sold out by political leadership, which was guided by socialists elites. And Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and that was was one of the founding myths of the Nazi regime.
And it persisted for decades, this belief in the stab in the back. And you can't understand the events of the next several decades without understanding how that myth, how that idea that, you know, we didn't really lose the war, we were betrayed in that way, how that shaped and formed the politics of that era. And so I guess in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that, you know, one of the worst case scenarios is that you have an election that creates that legend that shapes our politics going forward, that if we think, because I mean, and there's no reason to believe, given our polarization, tribalization, and the willingness of people to embrace conspiracy theories, there's no reason to believe that we, in fact, are immune from that, or that won't happen, or that cynical voices who have their own television news networks won't seize upon that. As we said, so we're getting darker and darker. I feel like we've stepped into a real negative vortex. So
but
give me
at
some
least
good
we're
news.
Not Let's... distracted.
No, this is the thing. In fact, as I was thinking of wrapping up, is like, so what are we being distracted from today? The president's efforts to distract, I think, are interesting, but we are still there are some things that are hard to distract from, aren't they? And although we're testing that, it is interesting. We still have thousands of people dying from the pandemic, and yet there is a sort of a happy days are here again. It's all done. We're over. We beat this vibe out there, and I kind of wonder how long that's going to last.
Look, it is very difficult at the end of the day, one would think, to distract from mass death and economic collapse. And right now, we are facing 100,000 people, Americans, dead. That number could, you know, we're in the 90,000 some odd range right now, but we will get to 100,000 relatively soon. And we are dealing with the greatest economic catastrophe the country has faced since the Great Depression. Now, I would think it is ultimately impossible to distract from those two realities, neither of which is entirely Donald Trump's fault. And I don't want to say that either is, but neither of which either can you say he bears no responsibility for. And, you know, the real question about the distraction machine is, how is it powerful enough to distract a lot of people from the reality that is staring them in the face, even when that reality is that dire over a protracted number of months? And I think if it is, we really have to evaluate, I don't know, cognitive science and the way people, assimilate information. But the rules of all traditional rules of politics say, you know, Abraham Lincoln's favorite line, you can fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time.
Yes, we're in this vast experiment. Of course, other countries have been through this experiment, and we've seen what's happened with them. So on that bright and cheery note, Benjamin, by the way, what is the status of Little Cannon?
The baby cannon is on vacation on the beach in Mexico. She is sipping a margarita.
Oh, nice.
and currently retired, but she's informs me that she can be recruited back to active service at any time that the country needs her.
Okay. Do you live in Virginia?
I live in the District of Columbia.
Okay, because if you lived in Virginia, I was going to ask you, without Baby Cannon, who's protecting the potatoes?
You know, Baby Cannon has many siblings.
Okay. You know, hopefully a large portion of the audience has no idea what in fact we're talking about. And some historian, you know, I am thinking of the... when people write histories of this era, these details, whether they will have, you know, we'll pick up on these details that on this day in history, when all of this was going on, the president actually said that we're going after the state of Virginia because they're attacking your Second Amendment rights and you want to guard your potatoes. I mean, how the guarding potatoes got into his head, I have no idea.
Why potatoes as opposed to gold ingots or, you know, apple trees or, you know, right, electronics.
Yeah. Or your virgin daughters or something like that. Potatoes. That's like, I need my gun to protect myself. I need to protect blank. Who comes up with potato? And by the way, speaking of things we're distracted from, so he's saying we're going after Virginia. So he's making a list of states. Swing states that right. He's going after. So yesterday it was Virginia because we have to protect the potatoes. Today it's Michigan because they're going to let too many people vote. Maybe this afternoon it's going to be Nevada. So we'll see how this goes. What could possibly go wrong? Benjamin Wittes, thank you again for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast.
Anytime, man. You guys are doing great work.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.